You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is presented by Forever Cheese. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I am your host, Katie Kiefer, and my guest today is quite unusual for me. His name is Eric Andrus, and he is a small commercial rice grower practicing the Igamo, or duck rice method, in the Champlain Valley of Vermont. You wouldn't have thought Vermont being a hotbed of rice growing. Eric came to farming through an interest in language, culture, and ecology. Very interesting, and has discovered in rice farming a way to enhance forgotten spaces in the northeastern landscape while helping people discover the taste of local rice. And by the way, I want some of your rice.
Okay.
So you have to tell us how, at the end of the show, you'll tell us how we can access it. I know I saw on your website that you've sold out for 2022, but I'm hoping 2023 will bring you a bumper crop. We're certainly getting plenty of rain. You won't have to worry about drought.
Not yet, anyway.
Yeah, not yet. Yeah, right. Good point. So I heard about you through my pal, Eric Hoffner, who is an editor at Manga Bay Times. I just want to give him a shout out. A longtime listener and frequent feeder of guests to me, you being one of them. Manga Bay Times, people, if you are not familiar with or you haven't heard me proselytize about it in the past, it's an amazing publication that covers environmental and ecological issues around the world. Always really, really well-researched, well-written articles with lots of information that you're going to care about. So Eric, let's talk about duck rice farming. First of all, how did you find out about it?
Well, I never thought at the outset that I would end up being a rice farmer. My interest in getting into farming was originally wheat and barley and bread and beer and those kinds of sort of more, European originated foodstuffs. Mm-hmm. And but I always wanted to do something with cereals. And many years ago, around the year 2000, I lived in the northern part of Japan for a year. Nothing farm-related, although I did tour some farms at the time. And I couldn't help but notice that the Japanese have a very organized way of cropping rice in a temperate climate. The part of Japan where I lived, Miyagi Prefecture, has a sort of a Pennsylvania-like climate, I guess mm-hmm. you could say. Snows in the winter, warm and muggy in the summer.
Right.
So I sort of filed that away, but I never thought that I would take an interest in doing that type of farming commercially until my wife and I bought this current piece of land that we live on and just noticed a lot of water pooling on the flatlands. And also we were dealing with the fact that our land has very heavy clay soils that don't grow other crops like wheat and barley very well at all. Uh-huh. And so I started thinking back on Japan and like, well, maybe we could grow rice. And here in the local diners, like when the cornfields were flooded and the soybeans were struggling, the farmers would say like, oh, we ought to be growing rice. And
really,
you know, they hadn't lived in northern Japan, but I had. And I was like, well, actually, yes, we should be growing rice. But
right.
At that time, I had no idea how to begin. So that missing piece of how to begin came from farmers Takeshi and Linda Akaogi in southern Vermont. They did a little citizen science project asking the question, could you grow Japanese varieties of rice in the Japanese way in the Vermont climate and have a crop? And their answer was yes. And at the end of that, they published a booklet, which remains to this day one of the best sources of information for people getting started with rice on a small scale. And it answered all my questions about how to begin doing this.
Well, fascinating. And the most interesting part about this from the consumer point of view is the symbiosis between young ducks and your rice plants. So can you tell us what the Agamo method really represents?
Yeah, so the Agamo method is a multi-species form of agriculture that has its roots back in Asia several thousand years. It's not exactly clear when, but there are very old woodcuts of ducks being managed in rice fields. And it was known at that time that ducks would stir up the soil and water around the rice, but would not damage the growing rice leaves. Because the rice leaves have silica, and ducks find them unpalatable. And the ancient Chinese didn't know what silica was, but they knew that the ducks would leave the plants alone. So,
cool.
Yeah, and nowadays, the duck rice method has been refined and modernized and adapted to several different countries and cultures, executed in different ways. And we're adapting it to New England.
Well, what kinds of adaptations do you have to deploy? Because it seems pretty straightforward to me. You unleash a bunch of small ducks, young ducklings, basically, right? Because I read on your website, they have to be small, otherwise they might damage the growing plant. So you want these light, little, tiny critters to be busy with their busyness, stirring up the soil and eating weeds. And so how have you had to adapt that method from a Japanese context to a, you know, Vermont context, for lack of whatever?
Well, it's incredibly tricky to manage the health of so many very small ducklings that are turned out at a very young age. It forces the farmer to assume the role of being the duck mother to hundreds of ducks at once. And they're hatched to not knowing anything. They don't know what the ground is and what the sky is and what water is. And you have to sort of like help them through all that and get them to start doing work and being ducks and hopefully having that result in greater and better food production. You have to sort of think like a duck, and it's really challenging. The part that is sort of locally specific is managing for the types of weather events and predator events that are unique to our place and not all that transferable from mentors overseas who might advise me, who have different pressures.
Right, sure. I mean, because here we have coyotes, fisher cats, minks, otters, all of them critters are living in, you know, where you are. Is that what is considered the Northern Kingdom? In Vermont, where you are?
No. The Champlain Valley is its own region.
Oh, Champlain Valley,
of course. The Northeast Kingdom is sort of more mountainous and sort of northern Connecticut River Valley side.
I see. I gotcha.
The landscape around here is typified by pretty flat, slightly rolling landscapes. But we occupy what used to be the lake bed of Lake Champlain when it was bigger. And now is just sort of a big clay plain.
Right.
And then we have a second location that we're farming now, which is next to a small river that flows out of the foothills of the Green Mountains.
Oh, well, that should mitigate some of the drought issues that you have seen in the past years.
So
to go back to the ducks for a minute, because of course everybody loves the cute story about the ducks. I mean, certainly I do. Is there a specific breed of duck that you use? And also, what do you just like get like many clutches of duck eggs from a breeder and then you hatch them in an incubator and then they imprint on you?
Yeah. We used to get them in the mail, which is actually... It's the most common way for people to get hatchlings is to get them by mail order.
Wow.
And there's a variety of places around the country that breed poultry and send them by mail, which results in a very urgent phone call from the post office at 6:30 in the morning. Like, we have birds here. Like, they really want them gone.
They can hear them as peeping gently in their little cardboard box.
Yeah, they are not happy with them in the post office. Right. They want me to come get them right away. But actually, through networking with world practitioners in the duck rice movement, which doesn't have a massive membership, but the people who do it are very interesting and friendly. A Frenchman who does the duck rice method put me onto the breed that we use now, which are called Moulards.
Oh, M-O-U-L-A-R-D, that breed?
Yeah, M-U-L-A-R-D.
That's a meat bird. I mean, I always think of that as a meat bird.
Yeah, it's a meat bird. So the female Moulards are not quite as big as the males, and they're more active. And they are not the highest scoring foraging duck that you can get, but they're pretty good. Mm-hmm. And their health is extremely robust. They're not as susceptible to getting wet, getting cold, that sort of thing. And they have done really well. And one of the problems we used to have is the type of ducks that we would raise were just not very suitable for meat birds and difficult to sell even as laying ducks because there wasn't enough of a market to even sell them for laying ducks.
Right.
So, and then of course, like, if you get straight run ducklings, what do you do with the several hundred male ducks that for which there's not much of a market? So now that we've switched to Moulards, it solves all those problems because they're all females and they're the type of females that would never lay eggs because Moulards are a hybrid duck.
Huh.
So they're bred in Canada by a hatchery that we work with. And the hatchery in Canada has a truck that comes down to New York State once a week, and we meet that truck along its route, and we get our year's supply of ducklings.
Oh, wow. And you only need the ducklings right after you plant your crop, right? And then just for a few, however long it takes. How long does it take for rice to grow from plant to harvest?
So there's an annual cycle that's pretty well fixed on the calendar. So we have to keep with the program, whatever the weather is doing, as best we can. And we actually have, right at this moment, we have rice growing in the nursery that's maybe about an inch and a half tall. And the ducks for that crop will be hatched at right about the same day when that rice crop is transplanted to the field.
Wow. So it's really split second timing, because as soon as you transplant to the field, you want to keep that, first of all, the sediment moving, and you want to keep the weed population subdued.
You really should not be waiting longer than 10 days to introduce ducks.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That's one of the things we really learned. It's like, it's just an incredibly busy time of year because we're working really hard to transplant the field, and then we have to rapidly put up duck fence and manage these hatchling ducks and then introduce them to the field really quickly.
How many ducks are we talking about, Eric? Just,
It's about 100 ducks to the acre.
Right.
So we're going to be raising, I think, 600 ducks this year.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, it's a lot of ducks.
That's a lot of ducks. And how many? And that's a lot of duck manure. I had ducks as a child.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I understand that they spend a lot of their time in the paddy. But when they're not, wow. Ducks are a messy bird, people. Messy, messy bird.
Yes.
Produce copiously, and it's messy and gross. I mean, I used to torture my friend. If I got sick of a friend who had stayed too long on the weekend, I was telling you what a terrible person I am right now. But but I would give them my duck Jesse to hold, and he didn't like anybody to touch him but me, and he would instantly evacuate all over them. It was a very good method of getting people to go home, let me tell you.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, well, like, that duck manure is substantial. What do you find other applications for it besides your rice paddies?
So the Mular ducks, they will spend about 7 weeks in the rice paddy. And during that time, most of the time they'll be in or near the water. Mm-hmm. So that manure disposal problem is actually a huge asset to the farmer.
Right.
And we have these sort of shelters that have a slatted steel floor.
Right.
So that poop will go in the water too.
I see.
Once the rice starts to come into ears, we have to withdraw the ducks from the rice paddies so that they don't eat the developing grain.
Right. Because, of course,
so they
would
not
love
eat
that,
the rice
leaves,
but they will eat the rice grain.
Right.
So that pretty much caps the amount of time the ducks can spend in the field, to about 7 weeks or so.
Mm-hmm. And then do you slaughter them for and sell them? Or, I mean, because you can't,
we
can't
take
be
them
keeping
to
600
processor.
Ducks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the Moulards make really great eating ducks. They, once they're out of the paddy, we, finish them in a barnyard setting and then take them to market when they're ready.
And do they eat corn? I mean, I'm sorry to get so granular about the ducks.
It's just a chicken
broiler
ration.
I see. Mm-hmm.
So we just give them a field with some open space and access to all the food they want. And they just go to town.
Fantastic. I mean,
the funny thing is, like, the ducks really have to, I mean, we do feed them a supplement when they're down in the paddies because so many growing ducks crowded into relatively small amount of rice paddy, they're really looking hard to find bugs and weeds that they can eat. But by most estimates, they get about 50% of their daily nutritional needs from the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And the remaining 50%, we go down and feed them from buckets. And that also helps the grower to maintain a bond with the ducks.
Sure.
So that they'll always come when you call.
Right.
So they'll follow us anywhere we go.
Mm-hmm. Now, how delicious. I mean, I don't know if I want 600 ducks following me, but that's a pretty cute idea. I mean, a cute visual, you know. Think of you and your wife.
In the beginning, I usually sing to them. So there's like a really, really clear cue. But then, like, once they get really behaviorally conditioned, then you don't even have to do that. Just the sound of like a car door is enough to like make them all start swarming.
What a riot.
So they're very, very attached to humans.
They're very personable. I love ducks. One of my best friends grows a lot of ducks here.
I used to raise chickens, and raising chickens over time made me like chickens less than I did when I started.
Really?
And raising ducks makes me like ducks more than when I started. So I think like the duck is my spirit animal.
I mean, to go on a small tangent here, I was listening to National Public Radio, All Things Considered, last night on my way back from, whatever. And they had a segment with a homeless man whose life had been absolutely redeemed. He was living on a creek in, I don't know where, California, Oregon, or something like that. And, under a overpass, and there was a creek very nearby, and he began going down to the creek just to, like, watch the water go by. And this black duck began coming, and he noticed this black duck, and they sort of made eye contact. And then the next day when he woke up at his campsite, the duck was there watching him sleep. And after that, he and the duck were inseparable for several years, and then the duck probably met its maker through a predator or something like that.
Right.
But it absolutely transformed this man's life, and he had a total bond with the duck. Totally fascinating little story. It just, put a tear to my eye. It was really charming.
The Moulards, I have to admit, like, they're they're a little weird as far as ducks go because they're hybrids. There's another breed of duck that I'm really interested in exploring in the future called a silver appleyard. And we had about a dozen of them here one year. And those ducks are really adorable. Like the Moulards, like once they realize you don't have any food, they kind of will go off and do their own thing. They just don't really seem that personable. But the Moulards were just like, they like to kind of come up and, you know, brush up against you, cuddle you a little bit, you know, and kind of stick around and see like, hey, what you doing? You know, just friendly. Yeah, I really like those silver apple yards.
Silver apple yards, people. Get yourself a couple of silver apple yards.
Yeah, it's a beautiful duck.
I bet.
Beautiful duck.
They are a beautiful
But they're very rare.
Really? Well, we have to take a short break now for a sponsor drop. We'll be right back with Eric Andrus talking more about the symbiosis between ducks and rice farming, and also more broadly about rice farming in the United States and where that might lead us in terms of getting our food system re-regionalized and reconfigured. Stay tuned.
Forever Cheese, a leading importer of cheese and specialty food, has sourced exceptional products from Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Croatia for 25 years. Offering a wide selection of artisan cheese, charcuterie, nuts, crackers, preserves, and more, their products are sold in stores nationwide. Forever Cheese seeks out the best of the Mediterranean and focuses on sharing stories from their family of producers. Each product has a unique story, and their goal is to celebrate each one. From Drunken Goat to genuine Fulvi Pecorino Romano, Mostarda to Mitica Marcona Almonds, and Duya to Jamon Iberico, Forever Cheese is proud to offer products they love from people they believe in. Their passion, quality, and range are unmatched. Learn more at forevercheese.com and look for their products in a grocery store, restaurant, or specialty food shop near you.
Okay, so we were just talking about the adorableness of ducks. We can't deny that. But we should move on and talk a little bit about some of the rice varieties. And also, like, for instance, I always thought rice was, I mean, everybody, I think, mostly thinks of rice as a hot weather. You know, like in Vietnam, they grow a lot of rice. In India, obviously, they grow a lot of rice. China, in the warmer areas. But you're able to grow rice in a pretty cold climate up there. Obviously, it doesn't take too long for the growing season. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to manage this, right? But are there other, what is the variety you grow now and what other varieties could be grown?
So rice is divided into a few, two species and some subspecies. Mm-hmm. The Oryza sativa comprises the Asian varieties of rice. So Oryza sativa indica is all of your long grain and aromatic rices. Like,
wait, these are pot terms. This is marijuana language. Marijuana is sativa and...
But the family name is Oryza. So rice. So, okay. Genus name.
Yeah. But how interesting.
Sativa, I think, I'm not sure what the Latin is for that, but...
And indica Oryza is... you said indica and sativa and are both
Oryza sativa. Oryza sativa. The subspecies for Asia is indica. Oryza sativa indica. And then for the northern Asian rice, it's Oryza sativa japonica.
I got it. Okay.
So the japonicas are all of your short grain and medium grain rice. Mm-hmm. So most, maybe not 100%, but 99.9% of the rice that we can grow in our climate zone is going to be Oryza sativa japonica.
I see. So that's like nishiki rice, like you would use for making sushi, right? Or sashimi.
Yeah, similar to that from a culinary perspective, generally speaking.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a sticky rice.
Yeah, it's slightly
high
self-adhesive.
Starch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. High starch content. Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. And would you ever be able to grow wild rice using this method, for example?
So we have wild rice growing in our immediate area. It grows in the sort of riverine estuaries and shallow bays of Lake Champlain. There's some challenges in trying to grow rice as a managed crop because it tends to want to grow as a community of plants in which it produces well maybe 1 year out of three. So the main real virtue of wild rice is as a wild harvested food. Mm-hmm. And to my understanding, the harvest of wild rice is an economic underpinning to a lot of indigenous peoples.
That's certainly true, yes.
Yeah, I think that it's fine in that niche. And but for one that wants to cultivate rice year in, year out, the Oryza sativa is kind of the go-to, easier to manage.
Yeah, I mean, because it bears every year and you can actually manage it. It's not a wild product. Also, I think wild rice is not a true rice. It is some other form of...
No, they're both grasses, but the similarity ends there.
Right, yeah. I got you.
It looks totally different.
Yeah, completely. So let's talk a little bit about the climate and soil conditions that are necessary for growing rice. Because I'm just wondering, like, could this be expanded? I know we grow rice in other parts of the country, but we don't grow it in paddies necessarily, do we?
Well, paddies of a sort. So generally, the rice industry in North America has tended to find places that are very broad and very flat where, hundreds or thousands of adjacent acres can be engineered for rice with usually large equipment, consolidated processing, and not 100%, but like a very heavy dependence on herbicide and, other
chemicals.
Chemical farming approaches.
Right. Well, there was a big, I'm sure you saw this being a rice farmer, but what, maybe as much as 7 or 8 years ago, huge controversy about the amount of arsenic in rice cereal for babies, because apparently for many years they were using arsenic as one of the pesticides or herbicides.
Yeah. Well, also
in rice
arsenic
fields.
Is very persistent
and it's
in
natural.
Soil.
It's a natural.
Yeah. So, yeah, and there's both, it's a complicated issue. There's both natural and synthetic arsenic. I understand that a lot of lands that have been converted to rice production in recent years had prior land use either in commercial cotton or in commercial orcharding. With arsenic being applied to them as far back as the 30s or 40s when people were using DDT like it was going out of style.
Right, right, right.
And that can show up. Rice is very ready to vector any synthetic arsenic that's already present in the soil, no matter how long it's been there. So that's...
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yep. And they were also treating chickens with arsenic for coccidiosis, as I recall, and then spraying that manure on fields as well. And that was...
Oh, really? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I'm all up on the meat side of this. Not so good on the row crops, but all up on the meat. So when you have a drought, which you described on your website, that you had a really tough year, I think it was 2020, so beginning of the pandemic, which was hard for, of course, everybody suffered in very many ways. You suffered a serious drought. What you basically lost your whole crop. That's a sort of a scary situation because how much water can you pump into a paddy, right? And where do you get it? Like if you don't have, because now you have the other field that's near a creek or a small river, but this original fields were not. And that obviously had a huge impact on you. Are you able to, have you figured out a way to manage that more effectively in future drought? Because obviously this is not going to go away as a problem.
Yeah, we think so. So for the home farm, in a normal year, we have plenty of water hanging around on the landscape, but we don't have a source of flowing water that never dries up.
I see.
Usually in a normal summer, we will have flowing water cease usually by around July or August. Mm. And I dug a large storage pond that I thought would be recharged enough times during the summer that I would be able to get through the irrigation season with it. And several times since I dug it, I'd drawn the pond quite low. And in 2020, I drew it down completely. There was nothing left in the bottom.
Wow.
And what I decided was that since I can't really enhance water collection or storage for the pond any further, I just had to reduce the number of acres that I was committing to growing from that pond.
I see.
So we are going to be planting some acres here at home this year, but most of the acres are in the new site, where we have a flowing water source that would not dry up, not even in a drought.
Right. Well, that's comforting to hear.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about the, you know, the sort of ecological benefits to rice farming in Vermont. Because you were saying, you know, it's like a magnet to other species. It brought a lot of other waterfowl in and, you know, that kind of stuff. Give us a little, paint a picture of that for us.
Yeah. So in a really simplistic way of explaining ecology, there you can say that there's like maybe a few major types of biome. There's open water, there's marshland, there's woods, and there's open grassland. And those being the major ones that are around us. Mm-hmm. And the more edge effect you have where one of those will border another, the more biodiversity you can have. So of those types of biome, what we're really lacking in the Northeast, because so many of them have been destroyed over the ages, is wetland, because wetlands have generally been converted to agriculture wherever possible many years ago. So we just don't have that much wetland. And I feel like when you create it, you have a convergence of species that are predisposed to taking shelter or foraging in that environment. And just by creating a little bit of wetland, you have almost instant transformation of the level of activity going on.
Amazing.
It's just anecdotal, but that's what I've noticed. Obviously, there is wildlife in a grass hayfield as well, but it doesn't jump out at you the way that it does in a wetland setting. And, you know, I consider rice farming a type of man-made wetland. Mm-hmm. And we have three different types of herons and a type of egret that all forage regularly in the rice paddies. And it's just really cool to be working around those animals.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So now once you harvest this, because I see we're getting kind of in the weeds here in terms of time. Once you harvest, what do you do with it? Did you have to buy a lot of equipment to make this, you know, a crop that converts into a product that goes onto store shelves? I mean, what's that process about?
So the Akaokis gave me a handbook for how to get started growing rice on a small scale, but they didn't provide that many hands-on solutions for trying to make a business out of it. That was never really their goal. But I made it my goal. And I found out that in Japan, farmers are already very well equipped for these technical challenges. And many farmers process and direct market their own rice harvest. Mm-hmm. And all of the devices that you need to do this at any commercial scale appropriate to a family farm, they are available off the shelf in Japan. So the only challenge is putting them in shipping containers and bringing those solutions to here where we can use them. So I operate my farm technically basically the same way a Japanese farm would be operated. Same machines, same approach.
I see.
Yeah.
So what do? You have to like thresh out the rice grains and then they have to be sorted or polished or...
Yeah, at harvest time, there's a combine harvester that goes through the field, and the combine harvester transfers its harvested grain into a grain-carrying truck, and the truck transfers its grain into a rice dryer. The rice is then dried down to an appropriate moisture level, and then the hull is taken off that rice by a rice huller.
Mm-hmm.
And after that point, you have brown rice.
Okay.
And the brown rice can be further refined into white rice.
Sure. Right. That we're all familiar with. Although we should all eat the brown rice, right? Isn't that the best part? Because you lose the germ or the bran.
If you were to ask most Japanese people, they would say that they prefer the taste of white rice and that they get plenty of fiber and vitamins from all the many vegetables that people eat in their diet there.
Sure. Right. But in America, where we don't have that diet,
we do here at our farm. We eat some pretty amazing lunches sometimes.
I bet you do. Absolutely. Do you have other farmers joining you? Because like in Japan, you describe it as more of a sort of, I wouldn't say co-op, but like, you know, people work together. Maybe do they buy equipment together? Would you ever do that? Like I'm trying.
This is one of my career goals is to help create a grower community around this crop because we've gotten as far as we have sort of taking the lead and taking a lot of risks and trying to lean directly on mentors in Japan and, you know, create our own system because no one else was going to create it for us. Mm-hmm. But I feel that for long-term success, growing rice in this landscape, it's best done with colleagues. And I would love to have more colleagues and to share what we've learned with them. And I'm not afraid of the competition. I feel like the first, 1,000 people that get into this at the scale that we're at will find plenty of market in their neighborhood. So I'm not worried about that. I think more people should be doing this.
Ooh.
And I'm currently working with Cornell Cooperative Extension to help develop a working public visitable model in New York State.
Cool.
So that will be ready to be announced fairly shortly. There's production happening in New York State now, too.
Wonderful. So we should probably tell people how they can, I mean, I have a million more questions, but I'm not going to torture you any further. But where do you sell your rice? Are you selling it into stores? Are you selling it on a website? Like, how can people access this?
So we do all our marketing directly. We don't sell to any... commercial processor because there is none. We are our own processor and we do all sales direct, both wholesale and retail. I would say that close to half of our customers are people who order direct from the farm in one way or another. So usually starting late summer, we open our website, which is www.vermontrice.net. Open the store for advance ordering of orders to be picked up on the farm. And usually around harvest time, we'll add an additional feature into the website where we do mail orders of rice, which come in 5, 14, and 24-pound sizes.
Wow. That's a lot of rice. Although I certainly eat 24 pounds of rice a year, I'm sure. Fascinating. Yeah. Eric, this is really interesting. And it's, you know, it's important to sort of reconnect the idea that, you know, commercial productivity is not necessarily tied to pesticides, herbicides, and large scale, heavy equipment, right? I mean, isn't that sort of the ultimate lesson of this project of yours?
Well, this is a way to get individual, like, for one thing, in the case of the Northeast, it's an opportunity for farmers to take some of their least economically productive land and make it into their most economically productive land. And, you know, you create homes for all of these interesting creatures in the process.
Right.
And offer a type of food that is not not in our palette of things that we consider possible in the Northeast yet.
Right.
It could be.
But could be. Wonderful. Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You know, I hope we can talk again as things kind of expand. You know, please keep me posted if something develops that you want to blow up on the radio, such as it is. So I really appreciate your time. And thanks, of course, to my sponsors, as always. And thanks to my listeners for tuning in. We'll see you next week. Until then. What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.